This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers, and Interactive Brokers clients earn up to 3.83% on their uninvested, instantly available U.S. dollar cash balances. And now those balances can be FDIC insured up to $10 million through their program banks. IBKR's Insured Bank Deposit Sweep programs will provide up to $5 million of federal deposit insurance coverage on an individual or institutional account's free cash balances. In addition, joint accounts are eligible for up to $10 million in coverage in free cash balances. How much interest is your broker paying you? Compare IBKR's rates to those of other banks and brokers offering less than 0.5%. That's one reason smart investors use IBKR to trade stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, funds, and more. Strength also matters when choosing a broker. IBKR's financial stability and risk controls are designed to protect client assets in any market conditions. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Rates, of course, are subject to change. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Compare how much more you could earn at ibkr.com/interest rates.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
CPI and PPI data released. Interesting story there. We got 90-day pause on the China tariffs once again moving ahead. And we have earnings overflow. Some good stuff going on. Our guest today is Meb Faber. All this and much more on episode number 934 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. In the heart of the summer, things are slowing down a little bit when it comes to some of the craziness that we have all the time, every single quarter with earnings season, with company after company coming out with their earnings, moving markets around. Not a lot of slowdown from DC at this point, but hopefully we're all getting ready to, if not already, back to school. I saw the school buses out this week. Pretty cool to see all that. And here we are in a situation where we are now having to deal with things like inflation, or the inflation numbers, I should say, and CPI, PPI this week. And we have to deal with the next shoe to drop with what may or may not be tariff related, et cetera. Last month was a great month. We know that. We know that July, that we saw a lot of things really good because earnings were good. Matter of fact, I wrote a little something down. I wrote some things and I sent this out to clients about July. And this was as July was coming to a close. And we saw that at the time, the global economy was really at a very pivotal. Okay, where are we going from here, right? We had optimism on one side. We had volatility that was kicking up. And they weren't just spending time happily together. They were kind of colliding and just really just smacking into each other on a regular basis. A lot of that was due to some of the policy shifts that we saw and political maneuvering. And I dare say the continuation of the rapid innovation that was related to AI. And that in itself was really reshaping the whole investment landscape as it has been doing for the last year, let's call it, plus. We saw these surging equity markets where everybody wanted to do a come along. The FOMO was just out of control. People were like, let's do this, right? Trade alliances were being recalibrated. Geopolitical tensions were rising. And that's what we've seen over the past few months. This chaotic rhythm, this relentless pace We're almost to a point we're getting to where it's exhausting. I spoke with some clients this week and they were asking me the question. It was very simple. Why isn't anybody bothered by any of the things that are going on right now? And I said, because we're numb. Investors are numb. That's part of the plan. Give them so much to look at. And then when the markets don't react, we then interpret that as, well, maybe it didn't matter. Maybe it did, but the markets didn't care. And if the markets don't care, what do I care as an investor? That's what's going on right now. The relentless amount of information, you know, the old trying to take a sip out of an open fire hydrant, that's what's going on. And with that, and what's happening there is that it is just exhausting all of us to a point of not even wanting to pay attention to it. And as we saw last month, the month before, and all the way through now from April, global equities, right, have continued their upward trajectory due to this, the great earnings that we've seen. And that's really particularly from the U.S. tech giants, where the top 10 make up about 25% or so, and the top 12 make up about 30% or so of the index of the S&P 500. We saw record highs, and that was driven by the enthusiasm from AI and automation, cloud infrastructure, Microsoft and Meta, NVIDIA. You know the names. I mean, you know all these, right? I'm not telling you anything you don't know. And even with the backdrop that the Fed is going to stand pat, nobody seemed to really care. It was like, you know what? It's inevitable. Even if the Fed is going to stand pat and Powell's going to stay in office until his term sometime in the next year, the probability is Powell is going to be replaced and it's going to be somebody who's politically aligned, and therefore we're going to see a rate cut. So we don't have to really worry because eventually it's going to get there. And with the wonderful earnings that we've seen and the non-existent inflation and a reasonable level of unemployment, et cetera, that is what is going on and is being put forth as the narrative that we're all buying into, and reasonably so. At the same time, investors, interestingly enough, have started to turn to income-generating strategies. In fact, a Goldman Sachs survey, they reaffirmed this as their, quote, year of income. That's their thesis, the year of income, where they really emphasized the idea of dividend-paying equities. They looked at structured notes. They looked at high-yield credit and all of these as buffers against volatility. And all the time, we're seeing the continuation of risk on, whether it's in crypto, whether it's in options, in futures. And the backdrop of this with regard to the U.S. trade policy and the pausing, the restarting, the delaying, all of that. And the surprise winner in this has been the Chinese stock market. Very interesting. You would have thought, no way. You know, after all the COVID closures, all the things that went on, how could China pop back and get back into place? And then add to that, oh, well, a few years later, they're open, but now we're just not buying from them. And in fact, we have tariffs against them. How could China survive? Miraculously, right? So right now, the tensions are really not doing much to be a problem. In fact, if we look at the tensions, for example, in places like in Russia or in the Middle East, all of these issues regarding, I guess, the volatility with energy, the supply chain bottlenecks, these geopolitical flashpoints, continue to pose a lot of risk, but yet at the same time, markets aren't reacting. Again, exhaustion and just inability to deal with this by investors, and people just lose the desire to care about it. So in August, here we are, and September for that matter, coming up, right? We saw this major downward revision to the employment number that everybody's like, aha, it really is slowing down. And maybe these geopolitical flashpoints Now, from the tensions in the Taiwan Straits and the Red Sea shipping lanes, maybe there's going to be some catalyst for volatility there. But yet, the market reaction and the convexity of that market reaction in this environment is kind of nothing. It's flat. So with that, I don't think there's going to be a lot of changes unless something does change. What does that exactly mean? That means that if we continue to have the threat of tariff, nobody's going to care. Of a higher tariff, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60% tariff, the threat. Everybody's kind of like, well, that's what they do. They just do that. It doesn't mean anything. The president who cried tariffs. That's okay. As long as we're all in agreement that is what's going to happen. If, in fact, we do see a change in that character of the way that it is not only presented but implemented, that's when things change. So even though we have this protectionism, right? As investors, the message, I think, is extremely clear. That's the point here. Because that's what you've been probably thinking. Like, what the hell? Agility, diversification, informed conviction. Those are the three things. Agility, diversification, and informed conviction. More essential than ever. Because you could get into a much different level of convexity of reaction. If you're just sitting there going, well, I don't know, I don't care, and I'm not watching. Okay, maybe 20 years from now, you'll be great. Maybe there are opportunities that are open up. And by the way, a lot of times when people talk about, well, you know, if you're trading, you're missing out on. Well, I'm talking about paying attention, looking for opportunities, not so much just pulling out of the markets if they're not doing well, but looking for opportunities. Because when you have small changes in sentiment or policy that could lead sometimes, depending on the market condition, to outsized moves in asset prices, that in itself is a defining feature of this cycle. And as we kind of make our way through August and into what is supposed to be a rate reduction period in September, I think continuing to stay ahead of this particular narrative is going to be really key. Key to what? To navigating what promises to be volatility, but, significantly higher level of opportunities across the entire landscape of investing. That's what we've seen throughout this year. Now, I don't know if it was a master plan or just luck, or if it just is something not even related to any of that, and we don't even talk about what's going on from Washington, or maybe we don't talk about what's going on for earnings. The fact is that maybe the investors in totality are looking to something else. Maybe it's something entirely different from that. Maybe it's not as good as we think it is. Maybe it's just simply sovereign wealth funds coming in and just shoving money in everything they can because they can produce the money and they have to find a place for the long haul, for a period and time horizon that is essentially infinite according to what they do. Same thing with many endowments and pension plans for that matter. So the narrative right now, the narrative of, you know, we just are numb. Let's just let things sit. The idea that these are just talking points and negotiation tactics. All good until something changes. And I know that's like, oh, well, that's obvious. Yeah, it is obvious. But think about staying on top of that and remembering that every single day, as you're investing and thinking of ideas to invest. Maybe a stock is down significantly because, I don't know, the CEO changes, or maybe their earnings just didn't get to where it is, or maybe a stock is up dramatically on an earnings that don't even look that great. Well, maybe you should do something there, whether it's buy some more on the dip or maybe it's to sell some more on the rip. So, something to think about. Let's Let's bring in our guest today because I'm excited about our guest. I love this guy. But first, let's talk about Interactive Brokers, because Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are from just 4.83% to 5.83%, rated among the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR's low margin borrowing costs to other brokers like Schwab, E-Trade, Fidelity, and Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points more. Of course, rates are subject to change. Margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. You may lose more than your initial investment. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go to IBKR.com/compare. Let's talk about our guest. It's Meb Faber. He's the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. He is the manager of Cambria's ETFs and separate accounts. He is the host of the Meb Faber podcast, the Meb Faber Show podcast, and has authored numerous white papers and leather-bound books. He's a frequent speaker and writer on investment strategies and has been featured in Barron's and the New York Times, the New Yorker, and he's a great guy, so let's get right to it. And we have with us Meb Faber, who is a favorite of everybody's and a great guy with a great podcast, with a great firm, some good stuff. Meb, how are you?
Amazing. Happy summertime, everybody.
Yeah, so tell us about, you know, I know we've talked about in the past about your surfing. How's that going?
It's great. I mean, it's humbling, you know. It's like markets. I go out there and get pummeled. You know, I grew up as a skier. So for me, this is a fun adventure. Anyway, a lot of fun. Perfect time of year.
How big do the waves get out by where you are in your area that you go surfing?
Nice part is I don't love cold water. So it's wonderful for me because in the summertime, the waves are reasonably sized. The winter is when they get huge. But then I can go down to a place I know you love, Cabo Surf Hotel, mm-hmm. Go surf down there, eat some fish tacos and warm up in south of the border.
Beautiful. Love it. Let's talk about some of the things that are going on right now, because I think a lot of what you've talked about over the years that I've always listened to and watched and read is the this emphasis that you've had and in a very, I'll say it a little bit of a snarky manner, saying people like, why are you investing only in, let's say, US when the rest of the world is this big, right? You know, with this home country bias and all this. And I think it done in a very good way to bring attention to this. But you've emphasized the importance of global diversification. I'm wondering, as you look back, how do you think investor psychology plays into resisting that particular advice?
Oh, boy. So, you know, it's interesting. There's this series we're doing called, it's like, originally supposed to be 10, and it's probably going to be closer to 20. 20 things that you don't know about markets. And it's meant to be a little non-consensus, some fun ideas. But one of them is this concept that where you're born influences your allocation. So what you just referenced is home country bias. If you're born in Japan, you put most of your money in Japanese stocks. If you're born in the U.S., put most of it in the U.S., on and on. And that seems normal, just like where you're born probably influences your religion. But even more interesting is where you're born within the United States influences your allocation. So people that live in Texas have a higher exposure to energy, people in California, higher exposure to tech, on and on, the Northeast, financials, but also when you're born. So depending on when you're born and kind of when you grew up in markets, Vanguard has this great chart that shows your equity allocation based on vintage of when people were born or when they came into markets is vastly different. And so, you know, there's young people right now that have lived in this 15-year romping and stomping U.S. bull market where it's been amazing. The best thing you could have done 15 years ago is just buy SPY or Qs and then just go to sleep for 15 years. 15 years is a long time. That's a career for most of us. Mm-hmm. But if you study history, you know that these regimes can last for a really long time. And I think every country in the world, with the exception of the U.S. that I have tested, and the U.S. is darn close on a rolling 20-year basis, every country has had a period where it's lost money after inflation and stocks. I think the U.S. is the only one that hasn't, and it's close, though. So the whole point being is that stocks can go a long time not doing great, but we've had this incredible period. And here we are back near all-time highs. So life is good. Summertime. Go to the beach. That's a summary, I think.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned some things that it brought some thoughts to my head about, you know, the home country bias, home state, home city, home wherever, East Coast, West Coast, North, South, right, in the U.S. But also the idea of when you were, you know, obviously we knew this, but really kind of thinking about this, when you were born in the 30s, 40s, 50s, probably you're not investing in too much crypto. You were born in the 2000s, you're probably investing in a good chunk in crypto. And that goes for a lot of different things out there. I mean, I remember my uncle once upon a time, he said, I'll never invest in mutual funds. And I said, well, this is maybe the 90s. I'm like, why? He goes, mutual funds were terrible in the 70s. I'm like, yeah, and? I mean, it wasn't everything. I mean, just look at everything, right? So all these things come into play. Now, I guess, Meb, as an educator, because you have the podcast you do, of course, which, by the way, I'll just do a quick plug for you. His podcast is great. And the Meb Favor Show, it's called, by the way, Better Investing, and many, you know, books out and all that. How do you turn somebody, their beliefs, to invest in other things outside of what they maybe just is right in front of them or they know?
So we're actually writing a new book. I don't know when it'll be out. I was hoping to get done this summer. It's called Time Billionaires. And it's actually aimed at this kind of younger generation saying, look, you have this sort of infinite runway. You have this amazing asset of time and you can compound in equities. And it kind of walks through why you should be global. And of my favorite investing book is called Triumph of the Optimist, but it looks at about, I don't know, 30, 40 countries back to 1900. And there's times when equity markets went to zero. So if you were in China or Russia, Russia had one of the world's biggest stock markets in the early 20th century in terms of listings. And then, you know, they decided, hey, we're just going to shut this down. And other markets that didn't shut down for, say, communist or political reasons, but just went through geopolitical wars, hyperinflations. You know, if you look at Germany, if you look at Japan, which didn't go through either of those. It just went through the biggest bubble we've ever seen and then had three decades of no returns. On and on and on and on. You would not have been served by investing in one country. And so diversifying globally, and this is particularly important right now. You know, the U.S. stock market on a market cap basis, looking at the S&P 500, we think it's one of the most expensive it's ever been. And again, that doesn't mean it's going to lose 80% or Great Depression or something, but it may mean returns might be muted. And so lost within this discussion is foreign markets are having a face ripper of a year. And and underneath the surface, the cheap stuff, so the value trade in foreign markets are absolutely having a moonshot and no one's really talking about it. So we're talking about, you know, indices being up 15, 20%, and then the global deep value being up 35 to 40. And so the sentiment hasn't really shifted. I haven't had any conversations with advisors this year where they say, oh man, I'm getting hot and bothered about foreign stocks or emerging market or value outside the US, right? So it's my favorite investment we often say is cheap, hated, and in an uptrend. And this is riffing on my buddy, Steve Sugarrood, but I think they check that box currently. And, you know, U.S., if you put it through that lens, is expensive, loved for the most part, and in an uptrend. So not terrible, you know, gets a little more problematic when it rolls over. But, you know, again, that's also the very heavy market cap weighting within the stock market of thousands of U.S. stocks. It's probably still be okay. There's a lot of opportunity in value. Small has been totally left behind. It's just been getting pummeled relative to the large cap. There's certain areas like healthcare is at one of the lowest levels as a percentage of the S&P, energy, of course, on and on. So there's areas of opportunity, but only thing everyone's been interested in is the NVIDIAs of the world, which is a $4 trillion now, getting to be a pretty amazing size.
You know, you want to know why. I mean, I looked at a client's portfolio yesterday, a particular client, and he says, hey, by the way, Andrew, what's my basis on NVIDIA? I'm like, you know, that's a good question. Let's go look at that. I'm like, I don't think that's right. That can't be right. You know, he's got like a $3 basis or something stupid.
Yeah. Rounds to zero.
Like, wow, that's pretty good. And you know, you're talking about at that level to where it is today, you're talking about something like, you know, $1,000 investments worth like $100,000. Something stupid. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And you think about that, you know, multiply that out across. But when it comes to the foreign markets, obviously something that you've talked about a lot. And it's interesting. We also have a lot of tailwind this year due to the currencies. That's been, what, 8-9% of some of the returns on top of the returns that we've seen. Is this something that's going to persist under this administration or into the future? Because, you know, the strong dollar is in the best interest of the United States of America. That commentary hasn't really come out of the Treasury yet, but it may. Is that going to trample this trade?
You hit a couple really important, interesting topics, and we'll kind of do them in reverse. Talking about the dollar, you know, real currency returns tend to be stable over time, investing for inflation. Now, that doesn't mean when you look at them, they don't go up 10, 20% in any given year. And this year has been a dramatic decline in the dollar. Now, no question in my mind, has it been overvalued on a purchasing power basis, parity basis. But over time, it tends to be a wash. Now, it's both a headwind or a tailwind, depending on your perspective and what you're investing in. And so we believe it generally it washes out over time. But again, it's a diversification benefit often of investing in ex-US. Second is when you're talking about the NVIDIA with your client, you know, first of all, that's awesome. You know, tell him to pat himself on the back. But that's, you know, that's how the stock market works. And so, you know, we did this great chat with Professor Bessenbinder a while back, and he wrote a famous paper called Do Stocks Outperform Treasury Bills? And then I had him, I said, hey, you know, I'm curious, what's been the best performing stock of all time? And, you know, meaning of the last 100 years. And part of this, of course, has to do with just something that's been around for 100 years. So NVIDIA has obviously not been around for 100 years, but theoretically, had you invested in Altria, which would be the old Philip Morris, you would have had a, hold on, I got to do the math here on this. It's like a 265,528,901% return.
So, wow.
It's about 16% per year. But it's funny, of the top five, I mean, Vulcan Materials was number two. Kansas City Southern was number three. But, you know, if you would have put $1,000 back in Altria 100 years ago, it'd be, you know, $2.5 billion today. But the point being is that, you know, power laws where some of these positions, these 10, 100, 1,000 baggers end up contributing mightily to the broad stock market, which is why indexing works. And that's one of the benefits of investing in everything is you definitely own the whole haystack. The problem is the vast majority of time market cap indexing is okay. The problem is when you get to these periods where, you know, the market cap has no tether to valuation, you can put a lot of weight in the stuff that's getting pretty expensive. And doesn't mean it can't keep going up. It just means on average, that can be its Achilles heel over time. And there's a lot of places where securities are quite a bit cheaper.
You know, when you look at the analogy, or maybe it's a metaphor, I don't know, I always forget which one is which, but of surfing and waves, when the waves start to crest, I mean, right now we have is this swell that builds, and it builds upon itself, and it builds on the inertia, and then eventually what happens, you know, the top gets too heavy, and it crashes down on itself, right? I don't surf, but that's what it looks like on TV, at least. That's what I see.
You know, well, it's why we have settled on in my old age, you know, this concept of, you know, having one foot in a globally diversified portfolio with tilts to things like value, and then having the other foot in a world that's tilted towards trend following. And sometimes they align and sometimes they don't. Trend following right in momentum right now, if you look at our global momentum fund, you know, it's mostly exposed to equities, but a lot of that is ex-US. It's got a smidgen in precious metals and in mining stocks. It's got a smidgen in Bitcoin and related, but the majority, you know, is long, right? Like there's no bonds. I don't think there's any REITs in that world, but it's, it's a long exposure that I don't think would surprise anyone, but a lot of what has been going up is also currently cheap. So to me, that's sort of a perfect setup across the board when those two align, but they often don't.
What is the risk these days? And what I ask you about when I say risk, how do you define risk in today's market environment, right? When things have changed dramatically in how we perceive risk. I've recently started talking about, we had the continuation since, forever, but it seems like forever. But since the big bailout in 2008, 9, 10, and then the continuations ones over the years, the buy the dip mentality, right? That anytime you see a big significant correction in the market, we have this V return, there's going to be a savior. But these days, that doesn't seem appropriate to say that. And I've talked about the movie Legally Blonde when Elle Woods did the bend and snap. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what we have in the markets now. You only have to have like a 2% one day correction and everybody piles back in. Is risk, this is a stupid question, but is risk left the room with a VIX at 17, with a market that doesn't seem to want to come down for too long, for maybe days versus months? Has something changed?
You know, I think the big risk is any investor, and this isn't just individual, this is institutions too. The number one risk is and always will be in my mind getting taken out of the game. So you're in a portfolio, you're in positions that either are far more volatile or riskier, or there's a mismatch between liquidity. We saw that with a lot of the institutions during the global financial crisis, some of the smartest money out there, the endowments, on and on, whether it's through leverage, whether it's through private investments, on and on, is getting in a situation that you didn't foresee or expect as being possible. And a lot of that just tends to be drawdowns, right? So if a particular investment goes down 50, 75%, people, it creates a lot of problems for them. So getting taken out of the game is, to me, is always the number one risk. So even if stocks are expensive, even if they go through a 50% bear market, if you're a long-term buy and hold investor, so what? Who cares? Like, it's an opportunity to buy stocks 50% cheaper than they were, but I think a lot of investors have the mentality of a just wing it. We ran a poll that was very depressing to me yesterday on Twitter, and we've run it over the years. Uh-huh. So I don't know why I keep running it, because it just keeps depressing me. But we were chatting with Ken French, the professor on the podcast, mm-hmm. not too long ago. And I said, how long does it take to know that an investor is good, that they have skill? And without skipping a beat, he goes, 64 years.
Oh.
And so I was like, okay, that's a little longer than I was expecting. But I asked my followers on Twitter, and I said, what stretch of underperformance by a portfolio manager would you be willing to tolerate before selling the allocation? So listeners, think about it for a second. And it was 0 to 5 years, 6 to 10 years, or over 10 years. And 70% said 0 to 5, and another 20% said 6 to 10, and 8% said over 10 years. But the point I was trying to make is, you can replace the word portfolio manager with asset class. You can replace it with all sorts of different exposures, value, small caps.
Spouse.
And all of these things go through periods of under or outperformance. Like, I don't think many people know, but gold and REITs have outperformed the U.S. stock market this century. You know, that's a 25-year period. And yet, I think everyone focuses on one asset. So, I think trying to come up with a plan and thinking long-term is important, so you don't get taken out of the game. So that having been said, to me, the big risks are, I don't see most of the fixed income marketplace having enough yield relative to T-bills. So some of the riskier corporates or emerging markets, on and on, 30-year, you've had this sort of weird inverted yield curve period that's lasted for quite a long time. And then some of the really expensive stuff to me seems quite vulnerable. But other than that, I sleep easy.
Well, what's interesting is that you mentioned the yield curve, and you mentioned the spreads. I mean, they're tight. That people are reaching. They'll trying to get any kind of yield on a municipal is impossible. You look at the high yield market. It's like, well, that's fine. Let's just get right in there. There's seemingly no risk. And I think some of that has to be said that during that period when we had that inverted yield curve that was really heavy. And do you remember when the banks were all in a panic for a little while there, where we had the situation where Schwab and all these guys were freaking out because they had all these treasuries, and all of a sudden, was that the I guess in 2023, when all of a sudden their mark to market on their bonds was just ridiculous. And then the Fed comes up and says, hey, don't worry. We'll buy it back to you from you at full price. We'll hold them. What do we don't care?
I mean, we wrote a paper on this a couple of years ago called T-bills and chill most of the time. And the thesis was, hey, let's examine historically, has it been a good idea to buy these risky bonds when you're not getting much pickup in yield spread versus T-bills? And historically, it's been a bad idea. But what you find is price insensitive buyers. So you have a lot of these institutions that for a long time, they had zero yield on their bond portfolio. And all of a sudden they wake up and they have 5%, 6%. 7%. So they're buying them regardless of the fact that you could buy a safer investment at 4.25%. And so it's created this really weird setup. However, historically, it's been a bad idea. And so looking at all of the entire risky bond curve, it seems like you're not getting enough yield. But if we know anything about markets, something hits the fan. And I thought it was going to happen in March, April, where traditionally those spreads are very highly correlated with the VIX. And so usually when the VIX blows out, the corporate spreads blow out, the junk spread blows out. And it wiggled a little bit, but not much.
Not much.
So yeah, that would make me nervous if I had a ton in those type of assets. But, it's more of an underperformance relative sort of situation too.
You know, last time you were on was back in February, and at that time was getting perilously close to that whole March-April time period, right? Because we started feeling some of the things that could be going on. There was some murmurs about the tariffs and all that. You know, I leave in my studio here just for the hell of it. Do you remember when they went up and they, when Navarro, Trump, and a few of the other guys were announcing the reciprocal tariffs, and they had those boards up with the, you know, the 36% and 80% and 90% Madagascar, that heavy trading partner that we have, Madagascar at 93%, you know, and Serbia at 74%. I don't know about you. I get all my clothing from Serbia, right? So, but there was a much different environment back then, right? And not much has really changed fundamentally aside from the threat from all these excessive tariffs. But yet, markets seemingly are finding every single day another reason to feel good about something. What is that?
Yeah.
What is going on there?
You know, you can go back to a lot of the ideas about markets discounting the future. I mean, we often tell investors, we're like, look, this is as good as it gets. Unemployment's low. Inflation's low. Stock market's at an all-time high. Like, this is as rosy. You should, you know, count your blessings, appreciate how much money you've made over the past 10 to 15 years, but maybe just not expect, you know, I love to watch the sentiment surveys to see where we are. And back in the late 90s, which I believe you recall, you know, they would ask investors, what do you expect stocks to do? And this is Bernstein, December 99, and all investors said 19% per year. And if you were under 40, you said 22%. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this happened again in like 2021. There's an annual, I think it's by Natixis, does a study. And we tweet these all the time. And, you know, it was like 17%. But that was actually after inflation. So let's call it 20% again. And so people, you know, they just extrapolate whatever's happened in the recent past. Again, it doesn't mean it has to be zero or negative, but if we know anything about markets, is that normal market returns are extreme. It's not like it does 8% every year. It does plus 25, minus 10, flat, plus 4, plus 30, mm-hmm. on and on. You know, and so the thing we've been rolling out this year is this new idea about 351 ETF exchanges. And so for people that feel stuck, like the problem most people have is they're like, look, this is awesome, but Meb, I was 60-40 in 2009. Now I'm 90-10 because my stocks have gone up so much, but I can't sell them because the tax man will kill me. And, you know, we've kind of, with our friends at Alpha Architect and others, have developed an idea where you can seed ETF launches and contribute these highly appreciated positions and get an ETF in return. And that's a potential diversification idea for people that feel like there's nothing they can do about it. They feel helpless. Which is a pretty cool, you know, way to diversify those positions. But that to me is the, you know, when you see people thinking there's going to be 20% returns, I get a little nervous.
Yeah,
because 20% returns, you quickly become the richest person in the world.
Oh yeah, you're doubling of it's almost like doubling a penny every day. Yeah. That kind of concept. I want to talk about the 351 funds, but I want to first. I want to ask you about private equity and get into this for a second, because there was this push for some time to by the parties that would have the obvious incentive to do so, to get things like cryptocurrencies in 401ks or cryptocurrencies approved for ETFs or cryptocurrencies for fill in the blank, okay? So that the masses can get in, why it's such a good idea and all that. Listen, it's because they want to have more exposure, and I'm not blaming them. They want to get more exposure. Let's just say what it is, though. That's what it is, you know? Okay, they want to make it easier and all that. Fine. Private equity, I was at an event with you in Miami a few months ago. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And let me tell you something. I don't know what it was, but like everybody's like, I didn't ask any questions. People are in my face, literally in my face, telling me how I should have private equity exposure in my portfolios. I'm like, did I ask you? I didn't ask you. You know, and this is going on and on like the whole evening. It was weird. It was very weird. I don't know if you had that same, I was only there one night. You were there for a few days, but at the event, but I was,
if you go to the institutional conferences or like even the slightly more retail advisor focused ones, you know, every year there's a different theme, and, you know, the people that are on the kind of periphery peddling the, whatever the hot wares on it. So if you went back to 2007, it was the BRICS. Hey, you had to invest in Brazil, Russia, India, China. Then after the GFC, it was anything tail risk or trend or diversifying. And then it was, you know, on and on, different shiny objects, China, Chinese stocks, and then it was SPACs. And then it was, you know, this cycle has certainly been a huge uptick in private equity, private credit. We've long held the belief, there's a couple comments I'll make on it. One is, I think the biggest benefit of private equity is breadth, meaning, yeah, you got thousands of public securities, but on the private side, there's 10 or 100 times as many private businesses. So just the amount of choice is interesting to me. However, there's been a massive, massive amount of money that's flowed into that world over the past 30, 40 years. And so what used to have been a pretty inefficient, low competition space is now hugely competitive, and a ton of money has, you know, like people, we wrote a book on this, people follow the Yale model and these others who were pioneers in kind of some of these inefficient ideas. But now every, like you mentioned, if you're talking about it at happy hour at a conference, that's probably an asset class that at this point has been, widely
wrung out.
Yeah. And so there's obviously the problem of the fees. The illiquidity can be a plus or minus depending on your point of view.
The transparency is a huge problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some of these. We have clients that usually what happens is we adopt these, right? We have to bring client in, and they got, I had some clients recently that were with an advisor in, let's say on the East Coast, and this guy flooded him with a few of these clients with non-liquid hedge funds / private equity / interval funds, which again, everything has its purpose. I get it, right? There's reasons for all this, especially for high net worth clients that can do, you know, can withstand having illiquidity on some of this. But I'm thinking, why are we having this interval fund that when you look at the performance, it's like that one is particularly no better than anything else out there that's a open-end mutual fund for that matter. Why do I need to be locked up in it and extra fees? I just didn't understand, right? I don't understand that one. But the second thing was, I asked the clients when they came in, several of them over time, what is it that you have? I don't know. Why do you have these? Well, the advisor would send me, this advisor was managing their money. They would send me these ideas, these things, and says, do you want to invest in it? I'm like, wait a minute. They're asking you if you want to invest in it? Like whiskey barrels, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Or some kind of, real estate that does this or that. I mean, and then you get locked up with capital calls and then with illiquidity. And the transparency is the biggest thing that really bugs the crap out of me.
Well, there's no question in my mind, all the academic literature shows that everyone in private equity and to an extent venture capital too, makes one argument, which is, hey, the whole point is you're trying to outperform and you got to be top quartile. And of course, my fund is top quartile that I'm selling to you. And the problem is if you look at the academic literature, private equity and venture capital can be replicated in public markets with tilts towards certain characteristics. And we've done a bunch of podcasts on this topic and over the years with Dan Rasmussen and others. And once you understand that, then, you know, it's kind of hard to accept all the high fees and illiquidity private equity. And you've seen some private equity replication ETFs launch. And one of my favorites that I've been talking quite a bit about, you know, to achieve the private equity venture capital replication, they leverage the portfolio. And so a lot of the private equity, you know, and the ones that are, I think, are a little sus, as my son would say, or a little questionable on their ethics and morals, they'll say, yeah, this private equity fund, this private credit, it's got a volatility of 4. And I'm like, first of all, we both know that it doesn't. And not only is it not stock-like, it's 17%, it's probably 30. And just because you look once a year doesn't mean that it's not volatile. And so a great proof is that to replicate the returns of private equity and VC, this ETF is leveraging the portfolio over 2 times wow. public equities.
Wow.
So that means your vol is like 40. And so, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that. And then, you know, the challenge that you mentioned that's so important is the mismatch on liquidity. You have a big drawdown and all of a sudden, you know, you got to sell something. And what are you selling? Well, you got to sell your public stuff. And then now your entire portfolio is private equity. So it's look, for the people that know what they're doing, I think you're, you know, go for it. I just don't think it's necessary. I don't think you need it.
But the other thing is that they're looking at when they present the public version of the private, a lot of times they're giving you the track record of the private, which is usually unleveraged, smaller, held for a long period of time, not as liquid, which gives them some advantages potentially, right? To it hides some of the blemishes.
Yeah.
And yeah. You have all of a sudden that's what they're using as their best match of historical performance, and that's what they're selling.
Now, you got to be careful because I also need to disclose that a huge portion of my private assets are in startup company angel investments. And so I've been doing this for over a decade now, and there's certain benefits to startup investing. If you invest in a company that's under a 50 million, and this was passed, QSBS rules was passed under Obama and now updated under Trump to 75 million, but you get a massive tax benefit. And I actually personally think this is one of the most interesting and impactful pieces of legislation either side of the aisle has implemented. So it's been on both sides over probably the past 10, 20 years, because it hugely incentivizes startup creation in the United States, which is a unique phenomenon versus the rest of the world. It's just leagues ahead of anywhere else. And so the benefit of the QBS, if you invest, it's like a 10x on your investment or 10 million, I can't remember the exact numbers that have been updated, is tax exempt. So for investors in the small world, and so we wrote a long post on this if you're looking for more information called Journey to 100X. If you want to learn about that world, you don't even have to participate, but just follow along. I think it's a hugely interesting idea, really fun, optimistic way to think about markets. But these are sort of things you put in the lockbox and put away. And I think I'm getting ready to cross, probably in the next few months, my 400th
wow.
angel investment.
Really? And that's good for disclosure. But you're also looking at these, and this is your strategy, and that's what you want to do. Different than being peddled this stuff. Well, they'll come at you too.
Yeah.
But being peddled as a non-investment dude, right?
Yeah.
With you're thinking that this, and it's not fair. It's
100%.
Yeah. So do you think, though, that private equity should be, we'll close on this point, close this topic, allowed into 401k plans? Is that something? Well, let me back up for a second. We've talked about this. Are we any further along with not getting rid of just the mutual funds in 401k plans? When are we ever going to get the ETFs in there? And it could be end-of-day ETFs. Is there such a thing we can create called end-of-day ETFs?
Let's work on it. We'll figure it out. You and I, we'll put our heads together on a fishing boat over a beer or something and solve that. But yeah, I hear you.
So talk to me about the 351 exchange funds again, because we talked about this last time. It was fascinating. Where are you in that you obviously evolved and you have a lot more going on now with that?
Sure. So, you know, I think when we talk to investors, thinking about fees and taxes, taxes to me are always like the number one source of alpha that everyone sort of overlooks. And ETFs have been a game changer for a lot of people for this. On average, if you're buying an ETF, you're not going to be paying any capital gains on that fund until you sell it. So it'll rebalance. And it's a really awesome benefit for the individual investor. And this is why you've seen a huge amount of flows out of the traditional high fee, tax inefficient mutual fund world towards ETFs. Great. Mm-hmm. I feel like everyone kind of knows that here in 2025. However, you know, as alluded to earlier, there's some challenges people have if they're in investments. It could be stocks, it could be ETFs that have appreciated in a taxable account. And then they want to rebalance, or they want to sell some, or they want to sell all, or they're a CEO and they had massive liquidity and 95% of their wealth is now in one stock, or you've been doing direct indexing for a long time and your portfolio is up 5X and you're stuck in all these companies that have appreciated. There's not a whole lot of options historically. There's some fund developments from AQR and others on the on kind of direct indexing 2.0 that's long short and leveraged, but those can be complicated. And so anyway, you know, we talked about this where there's 351 has been in the tax code for like 100 years, but the magical partnership really came with the ETF rule passing, say, 5 years ago. Essentially, there's a lot of info online. Listeners, you can find it if you Google my company, Cambrian 351. We got PDFs and videos and everything. But the simplicity is you can seed or contribute a portfolio to the launch of a new ETF. So we did one last December, we did one in April, we got another one coming up in September and December, and you get the ETF in return, and that is a tax-deferred event. So it's not a tax wash, that would be legal, but you're deferring taxes, so yeah.
So you defer taxes, you do it in the seeding of an ETF, which is an efficient way to do it, and then you mix it up with other parties? Or is it-
yeah, so let me walk you through how the next one will work. So we're launching a fund in September, mid-September. It's called GEW, G-E-W. And this oddly doesn't exist. So we're interested in launching this one. It's the top 500 stocks globally equal weighted. So gives you exposure to all the countries in the world, top 500. It kind of breaks that market cap link. So it's for people that want a beta sort of quant exposure. All in, it's only 25 basis points. So you're contributing, there's no cost to setting this up. And let's say you got a Mag 7 portfolio, or let's say you got 10 or 20 stocks, you want to contribute. It may be you and 10 other, or maybe 100 other, maybe 1,000 other investors. And a couple notes, you know, one of the regulators, they said, look, we don't want this to be a situation where people are doing this for tax reasons alone. So you have to contribute a diversified portfolio. And so the number one rule is that the biggest position can't be over 25%. So you couldn't just give me 10 million of your NVIDIA. It could be 2.5 million, but it's got to be 7.5 million other stuff. Right. It could be stocks. Now the cool part is ETFs are pass through or look through. So you could actually give us 100% SPY because it looks through to the underlying holdings. You know, for this fund, it could be U.S. stocks, foreign stocks, or ETFs. And the one we're doing at the end of the year is a U.S. top 500 equal weight. So that would be U.S. stocks and ETFs only. And then you get the portfolio back. And the cool part is, let's say you submitted 20 positions. Well, you get back an ETF, but it's got 20 different tax lots related to the initial positions you contributed. So you could manage the new ETF very precisely if you wanted to sell some or all going down the road based on the initial contributors of your, like you mentioned, your client's $3 NVIDIA position.
Right.
So it's just a flexible way to diversify for the people that feel offsides and don't want to, you know, make wholesale changes today based on tax reasons alone. Because if we know anything about markets, talking to clients forever, almost always when people make decisions based purely on trying to avoid tax, you know, say, I can't sell this, tax man's going to kill me. You say, well, the market's going to solve it for you someday. Doesn't matter if it's IBM or GE or, you know, whatever the position may be, eventually, you know.
Well, that's what we talked about before we got on. The tax man doth take it. We talked about the tuna in Cabo fishing, and, you know, you catch three tuna, and the tax man, in this case, is the sharks, takes two-thirds. You have no choice on it. You could be a little bit smarter, reel a little bit faster, but in the end, there's a tax to pay. It's what it is.
Yeah. So yeah. I hear you, buddy. But you know, the tax alpha, I think just making smart decisions on taxes in general is much easier than trying to decide what the Fed's going to do, where gold's going, how to, you know, will this expensive market keep going up, on and on. You know, the simple, and that's the beauty of financial advisors. So on this 351, you have to go through a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. The custodians won't let individuals participate because they're like, we're not herding cats.
Yeah.
I think this is, we've said this is a bigger idea than crypto ETFs. And I think, and that's a pretty big idea. That's over $100 billion. I think this will hit mainstream in 2026. You'll start to see some of the big boys.
And I hope you get the majority of it, sir. That's what I hope.
Well, me too.
That's what I hope. Meb Faber, always great to have you on board. I'm going to have all the information on how to get in touch with you and your podcast, your books, your papers, your firms, your 351s over on the show notes, episode number 934 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks, buddy. I'll see you soon.
As always, great.
Thanks. That's going to wrap it up for this midsummer. It is the midsummer. This midsummer podcast, episode number 934 of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Like I said, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out all there is available for you there. You can check out how we do what we do, how we manage money for clients, if it's right for you. Maybe there's something you've been thinking about, and maybe one of the strategies that we work on with clients is really appropriate for you. Check it out. Go there. Make sure to be here next week. We have some great guests coming on. We have, let's see, Daniel Park, Nolan Langford, Jack Schwager. That's just in August. So stay tuned. Lots of good things happening. I'll see you soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.